Hello, welcome to CarCast in Edmonds. I'm Matt, the moderator, DeAndre, here with Alistair Weaver. How you doing?
I'm good, thanks. Holiday season's greetings to you and all that.
Getting toward the end of the year, getting a little bit of holiday travel, I think, right? You're going to jet on off to Europe, this luxurious, glorious life of yours?
Yeah, if you regard taking an 11-hour economy class flight with a 21-month-old and a 4-year-old luxury and glamorous. I always say to people, obviously I'm British, and I always say to people, oh, I'm going back to, you know, my wife's French, so we have to go back to France, back to the UK. And it always sounds really glamorous, you know, but actually, it's not really.
It's not.
It's nice to see the family, but it's glamour. Glamour it is not.
Right.
This is not the glory days of air travel.
Yeah. Well, we're getting there toward the end of the year. I'm trying to get my headphones are doing a thing, but I think I got it. Yeah, so I want to get into a few things. Goldberg and I were talking a little bit about the Kia, the EV9, knowing full well you would have some more information about that. But I also want to get into the Fisker, because there's been some news around Fisker, and they're starting to deliver a few vehicles. I saw one on the road so far, and it didn't look good. It was in that blue that they've been sort of using as their flagship car. That's kind of interesting. But one of the things that we teased, I think, when we were covering F1 was Toyota Tacoma. As well. We just didn't really get into some of the new car stuff that were sort of bleed off from LA Auto Show. So I don't know. Let's start somewhere. Where do you want to start? Toyota?
Yeah, we can start with Tacoma. I guess that's the biggest news. I mean, I went out and had a look at it back in the summer in Hawaii when they initially announced it. And then we've had a couple of vehicles through the office now. So we've had it down the track. We've done the full rating on it. So if you want to check out the site, all you want to read about the new Tacoma is right there. But, you know, happy to give the game away on the pod.
Now, Tacoma's still pretty significant for Toyota, right? Like, when we lost Ranger and all the mid-sized trucks for a number of years, Tacoma was the game. I mean, we still had Honda Ridgeline, and maybe Nissan had something, but really it was just Tacoma. And now the Tacoma's got more competition. And it took a little while to get like a full revision of Tacoma, like we got now, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of what's a big deal. You know, what's a big deal for them is that this is a vehicle that will probably have a shelf life of at least 10 years. And I was talking to the project engineer back in Hawaii, and you imagine the pressure of doing a vehicle that, you know, is going to have to sell 200,000 or 300,000 a year for the next. For the next 10 years, that's not a small undertaking. And, you know, it has such a loyal fan base, and it's always seen as this kind of iconic, reliable, go anywhere, not let you down, do the job truck. And that's why people buy them, and why the residual values have always historically been incredible on them. And, you know, I think it's quite the case now, but because used car values are dropping very rapidly. That's something else we could get into. But the Tacoma, there was a while where you could buy like a used Tacoma was actually almost as much money or more expensive than a new Tacoma in case you could get hold of one. So, you know, the arrival of a genuinely new version is a huge deal for the market, huge deal for Toyota. And it also comes at a time when everybody else is updating. So we've seen the new Colorado this year. We're about to get our hands on the new Ford Ranger. Even things like the Nissan Frontier aren't massively old. So, you know, the big size, the full size truck market had its update, and now this year it's been the turn the mid size. So, yeah, interesting vehicle, huge range as you'd expect, including hybrid power now, Yeah, we had a slightly, you know, it's a good vehicle, but we weren't blown away by it, shall we say.
There's going to be, you mentioned hybrid, but there's two turbo four-cylinder options, and then the hybrid version, sort of a small, medium, and large, four-cylinder turbo, high output, if you will, and then hybrid, which will be the flagship vehicle as far as powertrain. And then two-wheel drive, four-wheel drive versions, extended cabs, four-door cabs, you know, there's going to be a whole slew of mix and max match options that you can get here, as well as a manual transmission. No manual transmission in the hybrid, although that would be kind of interesting, but it seems pretty standard that that's not going to be the case.
Yeah, they're also going after at the top end of the range. They're going after, had a look at the TRD Pro, and, you know, that's going after the sort of desert racing type community. They've got some really cool seat technology, which we haven't tested yet, but it has shock absorbers in the back of the front seats. The idea being that it sort of supports your body as you bounce over the dunes. And then they're also trying to get into the overlanding market as well. So it's the classic Toyota thing. They pepper the market with a version for everybody. We had the TRD Sport in. That's the one that we tested, which I think is going to be the critical seller. So this is the turbo 4 with 278 horsepower, which, you know, was,
and that's the mid-range power, because the smaller one is like 228 horsepower. So there's a 228, a 278, and then the hybrid's going to be 326.
Yeah, they've got a pretty decent spread. I think the hybrid is, in, you know, as Toyota has tended to do recently, it's not just about economy. It's also about that kind of balance. What they're almost saying is you can have the performance, but not, you know, but still have the economy of a traditional four. So I think that's what they're trying to achieve there. I mean, we ran the TRD Sport through the test track. 0 to 60 in 7.6 is respectable for a truck like this. I mean, you know, you question it. It's not designed, and it's called TRD Sport, but it's not really supposed to be a performance truck. There were a few things that the only thing that we really was slightly odd was the rear seat space wasn't as big as some rivals. And that was kind of one issue. There was just the one thing that has, sorry, I'm rambling, can't speak. It's been a long week. One thing that has improved, I remember in the old Tacoma, the driving position, although it improved slightly over the years, was always a little bit challenged. Now you can get properly comfortable. And that's going to make a big difference, particularly if you're on the taller end of the spectrum.
Yeah, not my problem.
I say nothing.
Let's talk about the look. So they're definitely going after this very short, sharp edge kind of look. I guess they were doing that on the bigger truck as well. I get the street trucks and the off-road versions of the trucks a little different. You're going for fuel economy. So that big plastic air dam that hangs down on the street trucks that sort of divert air and help improve your MPG. Wildly,
yeah,
ugly,
I think that's,
by the way.
Yeah, I was talking to them I was talking to them on the launch about that. And I was actually this, because, you know, it does look like it, you know, the first time you hit a curb, the thing's going to come off. I'm sure it won't. But it's been designed so it's pretty easy to take off. And I think that's a kind of emissions economy thing. So I suspect what you'll find out there in the real world is once you've got past the EPA ratings, a lot of people will just quietly unscrew them and stick them in the back of the garage, because they do look kind of silly.
They're goofy. And then especially when you look at all the photos, you look at the lineup of the truck, and then you see that version, and then you get to, you know, the Trail Hunter trim and the TRD Pro, and you're like, oh, well, those are kind of badass looking, you know, with skid plates in the front and whatever. So
yeah, the TRD Pro looks fantastic. And also it's the Trail Hunter, isn't it? Which is more of a kind of like out of the dealership overlander. So it's kind of like you go to SEMA and you see what everybody does to Tacomas, and, you know, there's a huge market, as you know, for modding Tacomas. And I think what Toyota's saying is, you know, we want a piece of that market. And in the Trail Hunter, they're basically saying, look, if you don't want to go the aftermarket, you don't want to do it yourself, we will sell you a SEMA car, basically straight out of the showroom with all the warranties and everything else. So cash rich, time poor, that's the choice.
Yeah, it looks good. It looks pretty interesting. So, overall, when you guys tested it, what was the sort of the driving dynamics of it? Did you end up liking it? I mean, the word is it's supposed to be a more comfortable, better driving overall than the current Tacoma.
Yeah, which probably, you know, the current Tacoma was what, 10 years old, so you'd hope to have a pretty sizable thing. I mean, yeah, generally it's much better to drive. The braking performance was good. You know, steering's light and accurate. So, you know, and again, it will vary a little bit from model to model, depending on, you know, how it's set up for off-roading or on-road, and, you know, what tires it's on and that sort of thing. So yeah, it's as you'd hope, it's much better on road, and I'm sure there'll be there'll be significant differences between which trim you choose. So, you know, it's kind of interesting, this market, that this particular truck market, you really need to think about how you're speccing the vehicle and how you're actually going to use it.
Yeah, you know, and this idea of the hybrid version. So Toyota's been doing hybrid for a long time. That they've gotten pretty good at it across their lineup of vehicles. And the hybrid trucks, like we've seen from Ford, is an interesting proposition now with Ram Charger or whatever, I forgot what the EV truck is that they're going to be doing. I think it's Ram Charger.
No, the Ram Charger is the hybrid one, isn't it? The one where you have the engine as the generator.
Right, that's the generator, not really the hybrid. That's just sort of the onboard generator. But the idea of Toyota pushing more of the off-road stuff, and like you said, the turnkey overlanding vehicle, I would imagine their hybrid version of the truck is going to start to have things like what Ford's doing with their Pro Power on board, so you can sort of power your campsite or charge, you know, power tools or whatever. I don't know that was a big selling point for anything else that Toyota is doing, but for the truck to be competitive, there's got to be some version of that, I would imagine. I don't know how much they got into it, because that truck's not really out yet.
Yeah, the iForce Max, I mean, the numbers are impressive. As you mentioned earlier, 326 horsepower, 65 pounds-feet of torque. I mean, the torque in particular is a real standout there. And that's down on TRD Pro and Trail Hunter. So, you know, I don't think they expect to sell a ton of them, but that's very much seen as the, you know, the halo product for the rest of the range. I mean, the heartland is still going to be the, you know, the sub-four-cylinder trucks. But it is interesting. I mean, this is very much, you know, we talked a little bit about Camry, I think, before on the show, and this is very much Toyota's direction of travel. What they haven't done is gone massively into the EV market, but what they're saying is, we're just going to build a ton of hybrids. So every version of the new Camry is hybrid only. And, you know, on the trucks, they're also obviously getting onto that. Obviously on the full size, the Tundra, but then, you know, increasingly on the Tacoma as well.
And then the Tacoma is available with a manual transmission. I'm going to guess that's only in the entry level four cylinder. I don't know if it's available in the mid range one.
Yeah, I think it actually goes all the way. Goes. I can't remember exactly which model it goes to. I don't think it's on the iForce Max, for example. But yeah, they basically said, look, there's a market for this. We're going to do it. And yeah, it's cool.
Yeah. So the hybrid, I believe, is only with
the hybrid will be auto only, yeah, because I think that's guaranteed to be auto only.
Yeah, so we don't really know the exact lineup of what would be available with the manual transmission, but having it available is kind of interesting. If it's a fairly decent manual transmission, I don't know. I can't remember the last time I drove a Toyota with a manual transmission. And to be fair, it's not like we get a lot of press cars with manual transmissions these days, unless it's the selling point, like, you know, the BRZ or something like that.
That's what somebody was telling me the other day, like the best security device for your car now is a manual transmission.
Yeah, there was something in the news. I scrolled past it where a guy got carjacked in his Porsche, in his 911, like badly though, like got pistol whipped, and they took his car, and it was manual, and they kept stalling it, and they switched criminals, like the passenger and they still couldn't do it, and they ended up having to run away and just leave the car there because it was a manual transmission. Unfortunately, the guy got hit, you know he got beat down when they were taking his car from him, and I don't know if they got caught, but that's embarrassing.
They didn't sort of make him drive it at gunpoint or anything, just because they couldn't.
Well, first of all, it's just a 911, so I don't know how many criminals you're going to fit in one 911. You can start stacking them up and, like, drive it or I'll shoot you. Like, it's so stupid and so dumb, but laughable that they couldn't take a 911. They didn't think that far ahead.
You know what the big threat to manual transmissions is at the moment?
No.
It's all about emissions and controlling the fuel.
Yeah.
I was talking to Porsche's up at Rennsport, talking to Porsche's engineers, and that's the big threat. It's not demand. It's not manufacturing. It's just that when to meet the latest emissions regulations, you have to basically control the fueling and really manage, manage how the engine delivers its power. And with a automatic gearbox, you can handle that through the computers. With a manual gearbox, you lose a lot of that control. And that apparently is the biggest single threat to the manual. And that might finally kind of tip the balance.
It definitely makes sense. I am curious if we'll get an interesting version of a car at some point, probably something high end on the supercar end, or of where it's both, it's a manual and an automatic, where it literally has a shifter that you can shift, but a drive mode, you can pop it into a drive mode, or you can pop it into a manual mode and row the gears yourself. It would have three pedals, but you wouldn't have to use the third pedal if you didn't want to. And, because we have automatic transmissions that we're controlling like manuals with paddles, and we have manual transmissions that we're controlling with paddles, but can we get a proper manual transmission that you row the gears but has an automatic mode? Maybe just a button, that's like a drive, reverse, neutral button, but has a shifter. It would be an interesting, it would probably confuse most people. Certainly if you try to valet park the car, it'd be like, I don't understand what's happening here. But
I remember it once with Aston Martin on the Vanquish, which had this was the early days of flappy paddle gearboxes. So it wasn't, it wasn't sort of double clutch stuff. It was single clutch. And you could pay Aston Martin Work Service, which was like their kind of like tailoring bespoke arm. You could pay them to retrofit a manual gearbox to a Vanquish. And I drove it once and it was great. And it was this wonderfully kind of like meaty gear change. And I think at the time it was like $6,000. Somebody told me, like, if you take an old Vanquish in today, it's more like $20,000. And I think the car has to go to the UK to do it. But they would basically retrofit a manual gearbox to the flappy paddle Vanquish, which makes it a much nicer car, because those early flappy paddle gearboxes were pretty terrible. The ones where you had to kind of like lift off the throttle every time you change gear and then like smoothly reapply it. And Ferrari was the same, and then the Aston. But I never heard it the other way around.
Without multiple clutches, it would be tough to do. If I recall correctly, I drove the Lotus F1 car at Thermal, and
shameless name dropping. When I was driving the Lotus Formula One car,
V10 car, cool, it sounded fantastic.
I drove the Renault V10 at Paul Ricard.
Oh, see, I just went to Thermal. So what are we doing here? I remember it having a clutch pedal, I believe, and they said you got to use the clutch in the first gear to get it going, but then once it's at speed, forget it. You just use the paddles.
Because I mean, that's how a modern F1 car works as well. But the modern F1 car, I think the car I drove had a foot clutch, because they reckon that people like me wouldn't be able to do a hand clutch. But like the modern F1 car has a hand clutch off to get
it off
the line. I drove
a foot clutch as well.
Yeah, and then you go into the paddles. But yeah, that's the same on a modern F1 car.
Yeah, so the idea of having the third pedal there in some environments is not a wild idea. It's there. Anyway, just kind of an interesting thought about manual transmissions in the future. Fisker, what's going on with Fisker? We're starting to see vehicles. I saw one on the road. It looks pretty decent. It's an interesting, I like Henrik Fisker. We're going to get down to getting some questions answered. Is Magna going to be able to build a decent car for Fisker, as opposed to Fisker trying to ramp up and build a factory on their own? I like it as a business model. is Henrik Fisker able to run a car company? He's a great designer, he's a great visionary, but can he run a car company? we're going to find out.
Should we start at the beginning? Because if people are listening and like, what the hell is Fisker? So yeah. let's start with Henrik. So Henrik was, I first met Henrik when he was the Aston Martin chief designer. So he took it over from Aston, from Ian Callum at Aston. And Callum had designed the DB9 and then the bones of the V8 Vantage. And Fisker came in and finished the V8 Vantage, which was beautiful cars, both of them. Yeah. V8, I think, particularly was lovely. And then he'd also designed the BMW Z8, which was they're worth a fortune today. It was basically an M5 in a very, very pretty roadster body.
Yeah,
I mean, arguably
a throwback
the last
design, and nice.
Not a great car to drive. I remember testing it back in the day, but just beautiful. Like arguably the last really beautiful BMW. And this is going back to about 2000. I think that thing was around. They're a fortune if you look at Bringer Trailer today. And so that was Fisker. Then he set up like this eponymous car company in the US that eventually went down with the Fisker Karma. And then that was kind of the end of that. But then he's reimagined another car company, which is trying to build sort of sensibly priced EVs in the Tesla Model Y mold. So the Ocean is a $50,000 to $80,000 SUV. And then they've got a truck coming. They've got the Pear coming, which will be cheaper. They've got something called the Alaska, which is a truck. Then they've got like a supercar, the Ronin, which will be a absolute fortune. I think $400,000, something in that region. Yeah. So they've got serious aspirations about being a proper EV brand. They're actually headquartered about a mile and a half from my house, which is kind of amusing. But one of the interesting things about them is that they've been built by Magna Steyr in, I think it's Austria. Now, if you've never heard of them, they are a hugely accomplished car builder, and they do build the Mercedes G-Wagon, for example.
I think they also build BMW 5 Series.
Yeah, they definitely do some work for BMW. I think off the top of my head, they do Mercedes GLB as well. So this is a company, they did some smarts for a while. So this is a company that you've never heard of, but actually builds a lot of luxury cars to an extremely high standard. And yeah. I talked to Henrik about it, about a year ago now. And it's like, well, if you're going to go and hire those to build your car, isn't it really expensive way of doing it? And he was adamant that, yes, you give away some margin, but you also give away a hell of a lot of pain. And as we've seen from, you know, Tesla initially, but certainly from Lucid and Rivian to a slightly lesser extent, you know, it's really difficult to build a car from scratch.
Yeah.
So there's an argument that if Fisker goes and outsources the build bit to somebody who really knows what they're doing, then in theory, you're off to a winner.
Right. So they're outsourcing all of the build, presumably getting some of that know-how and quality. But where are we with the vehicle? Have you guys driven
here
it?
We
have
go.
You tested it?
Here we go. I've just Googled it. Who are Magna Steyr building at the moment? Mercedes G-Wagon, or G-Class, as they call it now. Jag I-Pace, that's the electric one. BMW Z4, Toyota Supra, which is a sister car. These guys know what they're doing. And we're buying one, which is due to arrive fairly imminently, we understand. I think we've written the check now. But we also had a test car in the last week, and it's really interesting. It's really interesting.
Yeah. Tell us about it.
I could have gone on, I suppose. I wait for the prompt.
Pause, so take a breath, take a sip of water. Tell us how you like this damn thing.
There's nothing like doing it live. So this is called the Ocean. And it's a SUV in the manner of sort of Tesla Model Y size. So it's a rival to Model Y, things like the Genesis GV60, which we actually own as a family car, Ford Mustang Mach-E. It's that genre of car. And there are bits of it that are really good. It has the one that we had was the was the sort of the Ocean One, which is the kickoff model. And in common with everybody else, you launch with a car which has got all the bits on it. So this one comes in at, that we had was in at almost $72,000, which is a fortune. But the cheaper models will be coming in the next year, and it should start ultimately around 50, which frankly it needs to now, because you know the Model Y has got cheaper and cheaper. Ford's cut the price of the Mustang Mach-E, and the Fisker is billed as a sort of luxury vehicle, but it's not luxury in the way that say a Lucid is or a Porsche Taycan is. It's got to compete with those more mainstream alternatives.
Yeah,
there's a few gadgets that are quite fun. I mean, everybody who launches now has to have a gimmick, and Fisker's basically got two. The model we had at the top of the line, I think it's called the Extreme, has solar panel. Basically, has solar panels on the roof.
Yeah,
and the premise being that you can use solar energy to help recharge the battery. So that's sort of gimmick number one. Gimmick number two is it has a very large vertical screen. So most of the time you're driving along, it's vertical. But then if you want to stop to recharge or wait for the kids or whatever, you can push a button and it will flip horizontally, at which point it basically turns into a, you know, an entertainment center, and you can watch Apple TV or YouTube or Netflix or whatever you wish. So it's kind of quite fun in that it starts off like this and rotates 90 degrees. And then the third gimmick, which I actually really like, the third gimmick is called the California mode. And you push one button up in the headlining and all the windows. So the roof, which they're claiming is the biggest sunroof, I think, in the world, that opens. And then all the windows drop and the rear tailgate window drops like it used to in a Land Rover Freelander many years ago. So basically everything opens up. And I tried it driving around LA the other day. And it's really nice, actually. It makes it feel a bit like a Targa, because you open the roof and just having the airflow through the car and then out the rear hatch.
Yeah.
It's a really cool feeling. And I mean, obviously you've got to live in a hot climate, but if you live in California, I could imagine myself using that all the time.
It's meant to give it sort of the feeling of a convertible. Like if you were driving a convertible with a roll cage.
Yeah. Like a Targa, right? That was my
like
feeling.
Kind of like that. Yeah. Kind of like that. The solar panels on the roof. This is something that's come up, a few times in conversation, going, why aren't we doing it? Maybe because it can't generate enough power. And what does it really do? Does it just like power some of the accessories or recharge the 12 volt battery, not the full like driveline battery? But Fisker is claiming it does add some charge to the main driveline battery. And it's an interesting way on how they're selling it, but they're saying it could add up to 1500 miles of charge per year.
Yeah, I saw that. You know, in ideal conditions may increase beyond 2000.
So if you park it outside, you know, all the time during the day in a warm climate, California, Arizona, if you park it outside, the paint will suffer probably, but it'll suck up enough energy to maybe add a few miles per charge, saying 100 miles a month.
Yeah, I mean, we kind of like to want to get, you know, we're buying one of these, and I say arrive this month, so it's interesting we've got to find a way of trying to measure this. But my car generally, like a lot of my classic car, lives in the garage, and my everyday car tends to live outside. And, you know, we live in Southern California. It'd be really interesting to see. I mean, in theory, it's a nice idea, because you are wasting all that energy, which is naturally hitting the car. But if you're living in Michigan at this time of year, it's probably not going to make a lot of difference.
Right. Or,
and if you live in the UK, you're stuffed.
And also, like, this is a $72,000 vehicle. I mean, how much parking outside are you doing versus parking garages or your own personal garage or apartment or condo complex or whatever? And then, when you guys get it, I would be interesting to sort of dig into this a little bit more. Does it charge while you're driving? If you're sitting in traffic and you got an hour commute every morning or an hour commute?
Yeah, that's my understanding.
You know, does
that
it,
he's just permanently doing it. Yeah.
So it does it when its car is on or off. It's just constantly charging the battery when it's in the sun. So Yeah, I don't know. It's just kind of an interesting idea. So you guys spent a little bit of time with it, but you didn't get a chance to do the full test on it, the Edmunds test. You're going to wait for your...
No, we've done the whole shebang. We haven't processed everything yet, but there are some there's some interesting headlines. Like, the range is really good. Did 360 miles on the now famous Edmunds EV range test. Get the plug in. And I think we did a lot of miles in it. It's in a really interesting car. There's tons of space. The rear seat space is really good.
Okay.
We kind of like the gimmicks, but there's a few things that the interior quality doesn't feel. When I say quality, I mean like the quality of the plastics, the quality of the leather, just the touchy feely stuff doesn't feel like 70 grand's worth.
But maybe also, he's trying to do some sustainable everything in the vehicle. Like, the whole vehicle is supposed to be recyclable.
Yeah, they're making a big play about that, and they just sent us. I was just talking to Brian Wong on the team, and they've sent him a massive pack of document about how sustainable this thing is. And that's a big part of their pitch. It's also a bit of a part of the pitch about having the solar on top of the roof is how can we maximize the environmental credentials of this vehicle? So, like, the one thing, the basic build quality, and maybe this goes to where it's actually built, the basic build quality feels good. It feels better than a Tesla did at this stage of its life when it was new. Certainly better than a Lucid, arguably better than the Rivian as well. But what they haven't done yet for these early cars is they're just not really finished the software. And I think by their own admission, they're still adding stuff. So at the moment, for example, there's no cruise control.
Yeah.
Period. None at all.
But is there a button on the steering wheel for cruise control?
Yeah, it's coming. It's coming. It's like the old days of the chip shortage. There isn't a full one pedal driving. So you get, when you lift off the throttle, you get a lot of regen, but it doesn't fully come to a stop, which is the kind of definition of one pedal driving. And
yeah,
if you're driving
a
Tesla
anyway.
Yeah, I kind of am now. I got used to it. So that's coming. Also, a few little bugs as well, like sometimes the backup camera doesn't work, which is weird because there must be something about backup cameras, because we had the same problem with Lucid, same problem with Rivian. Now in the Fisk as well, the times the backup camera just didn't really, you know, want to come to life. So if you're buying one of these, you're basically going to have to accept that over the next 6 months to 1 year, every over-the-air update is going to be significant. And probably in a year's time, pretty much everything that you'll need will be there and a lot of the bugs will be covered off. But it's not there at the moment. Some things are buggy, some things are laggy, and some things just don't exist at all. And it's weird, like, you know, even with gas cars, you always say, if you're giving, like, you know, friend advice in the pub, don't buy the car as soon as it's brand new.
Yeah.
You know, give it 6 months for them to at least iron out some of the basic stuff.
Right.
And there's a well-known car manufacturer who, when they give out long-term test vehicles to media, will never give you a vehicle in when it's brand new. So this is a known issue, but it seems to be exaggerated on startups. So they're just saying, we've got to get the vehicle into the market. We've got to get a tenant. We've got to get some money flowing in. The early adopters are going to do a bunch of testing, and they're going to accept the fact that they haven't got cruise control because they just want the first vehicle. So yeah. The fact that it's built fundamentally feels like it's built well is a good thing, because if it's just software, that's so much easier to fix than if the trunk doesn't fit properly.
And then, well, how does it drive?
It drives okay at the moment, which, again, like, we're in a world of over-the-air updates. So
yeah, right. Let's say the mechanical bits of it. Like, what was your feeling from you or your team? What was your feeling on just suspension, steering? Just like, because honestly, the Karma that he did a while back was a pretty decent car. It just, the powertrain didn't work, but the rest of the bits seem fine.
Yeah. I mean, here the powertrain seems to work well. The range we got was really good. And if that's straight off the bat, like we've seen with Lucid, that the range has got better and better if they've updated the software. So the range is good. The range is good straight out of the box. It's really fast. The steering has that kind of like turning, that was like Tesla, where it's very, very responsive. And I think a lot of people like that about Tesla. It has that sporty feel that as soon as you turn the wheel, you get an instant reaction. The way they set it up with quite stiff springs as well to deliver that. Then there's a few like little anomalies, like the brake pedal at the moment on the car we drove. You've got like 3 or 4 inches of travel before anything happens. So it's kind of like, ooh, boom, and then suddenly it's on. The handling is kind of okay. I didn't drive it on the track. We had it down the test track. I didn't drive it on the track. I mean, it's not a track car, but I just drove it backwards and forwards on the road. Rides okay, drives okay, really fast, like all EVs are. But it did have problems with, like, there's a weird function in it where I don't think our 0 to 60 time was as fast as it might have been, because you can kind of dial up this sort of like full power mode, but you have a thing in the computer that says you can only use this 500 times. Yeah. I've never seen this any other vehicle before.
Yeah, there was something the company spoke. I don't know if it was Henrik who spoke. Somebody spoke up to about it and just said it wears on the powertrain and the battery. So we limited it to 500 times just so we can monitor data on it, because we don't know if it's something people are going to use or not. So the long-term result of that limitation, that 500 times, they go, it may stay, it may go away. We haven't really decided yet. It's just something we're saying right now, because they don't know the long-term effects of the vehicle. Like, does it start to dig into warranty issues? And they're just saying, we just don't have enough data. So we're going to say 500 times. We're going to put a limit so we can crunch the numbers on it. But they were a little, not wishy-washy. They were just a little like, we're open to options on this idea, because we don't know what the car is going to do. Like, if you use it 480 times, does the car explode? Like, they don't know. You know, like, it
doesn't. 500 times for like a full launch control is actually quite a lot.
It is, but it's, listen, when we started getting launch control in the first cars that were kind of cool, like a Nissan GTR, there was like a sequence of things happening and you had to read the manual and whatever. And then it got better to where, like, all you got to do is hit the brake, hold it down, mash the throttle, let go of the brake. Like, it's simplified to now, I don't know, it's Genesis or a Kia or something, just has a EV, just has a button on the steering wheel. Like, you just hit it and it gives you like, whatever, 5 seconds of like a nitrous shot, but in an EV mode. So now that it's so much easier to do, I don't know how often, they don't know how often people will use the button. I reckon twice.
I reckon the day you buy the car and the day that you show off to your best friend, and that's probably it.
Yeah. So I don't know, the first couple of months as you're showing it off to everybody, that's the button you hit, and then does it wear off? But yeah, there's some, when I was driving the Genesis, like I would hit that button every now and then on, you know, on a nice clear empty road. It was like, just getting up to speed. I don't know. It doesn't make me angry. This whole like 500 limitation doesn't make me angry, because I get the value of data, right? And they need to record the data.
The only one I can compare it to is, I remember back in the day, it's still true today, if we ever test a Lamborghini, for example, at a test track, they always want to send an engineer down to make sure the car's fine.
Yeah.
And I remember, like, back in the day, Ferrari's always been very fastidious about this. And I remember going way back in the UK having a Ferrari 599. And I remember ringing the guy from Ferrari UK and saying, look, we just want to do a 0 to 60. Can I just check something on the car that I want to make sure that I've, like, you know, got it set up right? And he's just like a big pregnant pause. He said, no, I got to come down. And then there's like, and then about 10 minutes later, a 458 like came in at about 300 miles an hour. All the laptops came out, and it was all about like clutch wear. How was that going to impact on this? Where we were on clutch wear? How much was it going to slip? And it made you realize just like how much strain on the vehicle and how, you know, like absolutely paranoid. So the idea that you could just do this on repeat for like, you know, the 20-year life cycle of a vehicle is absurd. And I suppose this in the electric vehicle world is just the same thing. It's like the force that goes through the vehicle, not just the powertrain, but everything, is still huge.
You know, my experience with that was interesting. It was sort of the opposite. I was at Willow Springs with a couple of LFAs. it was just a handful of us. It was myself, Ken Gucci, Paul Walker, when he was live, it was right before his accident. And they had a couple of LFAs up there, and they sent two engineers from Japan, and I don't even think they spoke English. They were just properly well-dressed and their white pressed, you know, Lexus polo shirts. And they were just hanging out, talking to each other the whole time. And it was like crazy sandstorm and wind. And Ken Kushi was there and he was trying to slide the car around. And it was like, everyone was just hammering on these cars. And we'd bring them in, let the cars rest, let the cars cool down. And we kept going to the engineers going, do you need to check anything? Do you need to check the tire pressure? Do you get data? And they're like, no, LFA. I'm like, what? They're like, that's all they kept saying. They're like, there's no problems with our car. They're like, why are you here? They're like, Lexus, LFA. That's all they kept saying to me. I was like,
fantastic.
No, I get it. I get it. But did you really make a car that good? They were so confident in that car's ability to just get beat on all day. And honestly, we didn't have an issue at all.
And that engine was, I know we're going off at a tangent, but that engine was something else.
Honestly, one of the best sounding engines. One of the best sounding engines ever produced.
I almost got taken around the Nürburgring Nordschleife by one of their test drives in LFA. That was, they're insane money today, but the engine was pretty special.
The LFA is worth a lot of money, and the Nürburgring edition that you're talking about is already like doubled. Now we've got sort of this Miura versus Miura SV sort of separation between the cars. Like they've popped, and the Nürburgring edition is crazy. Yeah,
going back to Fisker, it's kind of interesting that this whole world of startups and everything else. Like, I drove it home, and then I had to move our car, a Genesis GV60, which is just over 50 grand's worth, so 20 grand cheaper than the Fisker. And the thing is, the Genesis doesn't have the fancy California mode. It's not quite as big. It doesn't go quite as fast, but it's beautifully engineered. The attention to detail is fantastic. The build quality is amazing. And this is the challenge today, and the challenge that Tesla never had, because Tesla basically had the market to himself with the Model 3. So they could get away with stuff that other startups can't. And, you know, we've seen it with Lucid as well. It's hard now, because you get into the Genesis, it's like, oh, well, the Fisker's kind of a bit cooler and it goes a bit faster and it's a bit bigger and it's got this like fancy California mode. Then you get in the Genesis, it's like everything works. Everything's beautifully done. The quality is fantastic. And part of me is just like, you'd end up buying the Genesis. And so if you're doing a startup today, you've got to, it's not just enough to like have a crazy gimmick. You've got to really nail the quality and the attention to detail and everything else. It's really tough.
Yeah. All right, let's shift gears a little bit to Kia EV9. I watched your guys' video on this. It was fun video. The summary of it is the Kia EV9 is essentially Kia's all-electric version of the Telluride as far as what they're trying to sort of go after. Now, there's going to be a price difference, and they're probably going to do some things to make it feel a little bit more upscale. But keep in mind, it's still a Kia, not a Genesis. That being said, yeah, let's talk about it. How do you guys like EV9?
Honestly, it is one of the best vehicles we've driven in a long, long time. It's that good.
Yeah,
it really is.
For what it is, it's not like the fastest, best handling thing in the
planet. I mean, like,
as a three-row SUV,
as a product, yeah, as a vehicle,
yeah,
you know, it's funny. I saw the concept car and I thought, I don't really like the way that thing looks. And then the production version is rare. The production version, I think, looks better than the concept, but it's just, there hasn't been a proper three-row electric SUV in the market. Because you have you've got the Tesla Model X. You've also got the Rivian R1S, but they're both a ton of money. You know, the Rivian's best part of 90 grand. And the Kia is still not cheap. You want to pay 60 grand you probably want the all-wheel drive version with a longer battery. That's starting at just over 60 grand. So, you know, we're not talking about a cheap vehicle here. But it's just beautifully delivered. It's like a proper three-row American family car with tons of space, tons of technology, good to drive, really refined, nice ride quality, great, you know, interior quality in terms of the touchy feely stuff. It's just really well done. And for the minute, at least, probably for the next few months, there's going to be nothing like it. Nobody else has got a 3-row EV coming out.
Not until what, Volvo?
Well, EX90 is accessory, but that's going to be more money as well. That's way up in the luxury bracket. So, yeah, in that kind of mainstream-ish. I mean, 60 grand is barely mainstream, but it's you know, nothing. There's nothing else like it, and they've done a really, really great job with it. Also, charges really fast, lots of range. So yeah, lots of
So speaking of range, stuff. What kind of range are you guys? Did you guys do your test, or we just have the manufacturer's range?
Yeah, we did the Edmunds EV range test on it. I knew you were going to ask me that, and of course, I haven't got it in front of me. But we exceeded the manufacturer claim, and I'm going to have to look it up, Matt, because I can't find where I put it. Keep talking.
Okay.
I'll have a
yeah.
look.
Yeah. And then as far as the one you guys tested, this was sort of the top spec one. This is the all-wheel drive, what they call their GT line.
Yeah, it did just over 300 miles. The long-range battery just did just over 300 miles in our test, which for a 3-row SUV is really good. And it also has the fast charging architecture that the EV9 and the Hyundais have. So it's going to charge fast as well. So it works as an electric car, and then it works as a family SUV. And I think that's a great combination.
So the one that that you guys got your hands on, being their top of the line one, it had multiple screens in it and heated and cooled seats, adaptive cruise control, front and rear sunroofs. I guess it has an air ride suspension, some sort of self-leveling suspension, and it's the dual motor all-wheel drive. So it was a 99.8 kilowatt battery, 379 horsepower, 516 pound feet of torque, but still a large vehicle, so it weighed 6,000 pounds.
Yeah, I mean, you can't really get away from that.
Around pretty quickly.
Yeah, I mean, we did 0 to 60 4.7 seconds, which is, you know, plenty fast enough for a family vehicle.
Yeah.
And it's nice that you can either get it with 6 or 7 seats, and in the 6-seater version in particular, you know, you've got proper room for adults. This is a proper 3-row. It's not a it's not like a, you know, 3rd row just for kids. This is a proper 3-row, and just, you know, really nice attention to detail. It's a really cool thing.
So this is going to be interesting, because we've had a couple of years now where we're seeing products from Kia, Genesis, Hyundai even, but especially with Kia and Telluride and Genesis, have been getting rave reviews. And it started off with, this is a good vehicle. Maybe they were just smart. Maybe they got lucky. To now they're having sequels and it's happening again and again. They're having pretty decent vehicles. Like, I'd like to see sort of the long-term results of these. Maybe we start to go back and have a conversation about like a long-term Telluride and see if that held its own.
But we had one. It was good. Yeah, I mean, they're smashing it out of the park. And you mentioned the Telluride, because you remember they did the Stinger, and Kia was really smart. What they basically did was go out and hire European designers, European chassis engineers, then empower them to do the job, but also bring up all the local talent at the same time. So they have super talented people that have been empowered. They've got a pretty, you know, they're obviously a forward-thinking company that's moving very fast. They're willing to experiment. You know, a lot of other companies like, you know, what are we doing with EVs? They're all in on it. And, you know, they're just knocking it out of the park at the moment. I mean, the Stinger was supposed to be this kind of like breakthrough vehicle for them. And it sort of was, but it was a four-door sedan. And, you know, it was kind of a nice vehicle, but it didn't necessarily come. And then the Telluride came along and it almost caught us by surprise. It was this big the 3-row for the US market. And it's just been an absolute phenomenon. For years, they were selling above MSRP. They're still selling strongly. And what the EV9 is basically an EV version of a Telluride that makes the most use of EV technology. It's a bit bigger inside than a Telluride. Technology feels like a little bit more, you know, a little bit more next generation. So, yeah, I mean, it's crazy at the moment. They really seem like they can do no wrong. I mean, Genesis is flying. They're doing some great products. Hyundai's doing some really interesting stuff, and then Kia as well. And we used to talk about like Honda and Toyota and the Japanese. Now it's all about Kia and Genesis and Hyundai.
And I think we'll have that conversation again about companies like Honda and Acura and Toyota and stuff. With the EVs that Acura has coming out, which is kind of interesting. The shared platform with Cadillac, although Acura claims they did it better.
Yeah, that's going to
I
be.
guess
But
we'll
then
see.
Honda's also then cancelled the big deal with GM to do cheaper EVs. They're going to go down their own route. So it's really interesting times. I mean, like the Koreans just feel like they're ahead of the game. And, you know, the Japanese brands, traditionally a lot more conservative, are. There's two ways of looking at it. Either they're being caught out and they're playing catch up, or they're just looking at the market and saying, this EV thing's not quite here yet, and we're going to sell up. We're going to send billions of hybrids and make a ton of money, and then we'll have EVs ready when the market wants them.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, I mean, I think we're expecting some big announcement from Honda in January regarding EVs at CES, which, you know, another trade show that I'm not exactly sure, are people going, are people not
I'm
going?
going.
I'm not, you're going, so you can go. Have a good time.
Yeah.
You can go. But yes, that was delivered to our inboxes fairly recently, saying that Honda is going to introduce an EV prototype. And I guess they're going to have a discussion about how they plan to introduce 30 new EVs by 2030.
Yeah, that's what I mean. The Japanese basically said, okay, we're going to wait, let the market pick up and then get into it.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, Hyundai, Genesis, Kia have gone a little bit earlier, but, you know, it's also. It's not that easy to sell an EV right now.
When I first read it, it was like 30 EVs by 2030. It's like, I don't think Honda has 30 vehicles, including different trims and options. Like, I don't even think there's 30 configurations total of all of the vehicles in their catalog. So
is that vehicles? Does that include that little electric bike they've done that, you know, falls into a briefcase? Maybe
the electric bike. Yeah. Maybe
Asimo,
that. Maybe.
Asimo's got it. Asimo the robot's got his own little car. I don't know. There are all sorts of things.
Maybe he rides a little electric bike around. The little robot rides the electric bike. That would be interesting to see.
I want one of those electric bikes. You know what I'm talking about? They're like the little electric bike that folds into a briefcase.
Yeah, cool.
What they call the mono. What's it called? I can't remember what it's called.
I forgot what
it
was.
It?
I was just out at the Purist toy drive car show, and Sean Lee, who runs it, he was there and he was riding one. He's like, this was like the first one. This is the Honda prototype.
Moto Compacto is what it's called.
It's
$1,000. It's $1,000.
Yeah. It's cool looking. It's kind of interesting. What it weighs like 40 pounds, something like that.
Like, yeah. The idea of it's all about like, you hear like the industry talk about the last mile.
Yeah.
So how do you get like the last mile? And the idea is that you like unfold this from the trunk and you can cruise along. I'd love it. I mean, they're $1,000. Maybe we should, you know, maybe we could split one, Matt.
I think it's cool as hell. And I can't not think about Tanner Faust. And I know you guys heard this story, but when we went to Willow Springs, he flew his plane from Orange County and then he unfolded a bike in his plane and he landed at the airport nearby and he biked over to the track. And then we drove cars and then he biked back to his plane and flew home. I was like, for 50 pounds, why not throw this briefcase in the back of your plane? And then you have this electric bike, although he's a fit guy, so maybe he just wants to pedal.
That's good fun. I just can't work out whether I'd look like cool in my neighborhood or just look, I don't know. Also, I'm 6'4". I need to work out like what.
I was just going to say, I don't know if it comes in a big and tall version.
Like if there's an XL version.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's lots of cool stuff at the moment. It's exciting times. There you go. Maximum product specs. If you've never seen one of these things, Google it. It's Moto Compacto, which presumably means small motorbike. 50 mph top speed, 12 miles range. So not that far. Charges in 3.5 hours, 7 seconds, 0 to 15. And weight capacity, 265 pounds. Oh, all right, Matt. We're under 265 pounds. Goldberg might struggle.
That's true. He might actually.
See, right on the cusp, 265? No, he's got to be more than that, right? What's Goldberg?
He's not in his fighting weight right now. I think he was fighting at like 285. He's probably 265, 260. I mean, he's getting old. We'll see.
Yeah.
He's starting to thin out a little. Anyway, it looks fantastic. All right, we're we're gonna wrap it up. We covered everything we were gonna cover.
Oh, I've also discovered you can get like a really cool like helmet to go with it. $169 for a little Moto Compacto helmet. It's cool. Right, soon we're gonna get one of these in. We're gonna road test it for the podcast.
You should do the full.
Maybe we could have like a race around your warehouse, Matt. Let's do that.
Around the
It's nearly Christmas. Okay, let's have some fun.
Yeah, weighs 41.3 pounds.
Yeah, 20. Yeah, they can pick that up.
You totally can pick that up.
Yeah.
For now. I can pick it up for now. We'll see what happens to me in the next few years. Yeah, it's neat. It's cool. I like the idea. You could basically store this in the frunk of your Lightning and just ride it around when you don't need to drive the truck, right? Because it's not huge. Anyway, all right. Let's see. I guess we'll have to check the schedule and see if we got another.
Yeah, we get a holiday special next week.
We're gonna do one more show before you jet on off to Europe.
The internet works in Europe. We could always do it from there, I suppose. You know,
that's true. I don't trust your travel schedule, but okay. Yeah, let's at least get show.
I might be a bit broken.
See how it goes. It's weird time difference. I don't want to get up early for this. All right, guys, thanks so much. I appreciate it. Edmunds.com is the website for all of the stuff that we've been talking about here. You can follow their YouTube channel, plus all of their videos are on their website as well, at least links to the videos. You can catch them there. So I think we're gonna wrap it up today. Until next time, keep the air and the spare in the bag and the wheel.
For the latest updates and call-in times, follow the show on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at CarCast Show. If you'd like to write in, fill out the form on CarCastShow.com. And don't forget to give us a nice rating on iTunes. CarCast is a Corolla Digital production and is produced by Chris Loxamana. For more information, visit CarCastShow.com.